brings to the course of events in Germany two things. First, that any such policy as socialism or planned economy will inevitably lead to totalitarianism and dictatorship. And second, that such a social order will inevitably fall under the control of the worst individuals. The argument is naturally political rather than economic, except in the indirect sense that the problems solved, the functions performed by the open market system of organization are economic, and they cannot be solved or performed by government under a free political order, nor the open market system itself maintained under a democratic political regime. There is little or no economic theory in the book. The 15 short chapters ably describe the old liberalism and contrast it with current tendencies, which are virtually antithetical, and discuss such problems as individualism, democracy, the rule of law, security and freedom, the place of truth in political and social life, the relation between material conditions and ideal ends, and the problem of international order. When I say that the argument is well stated, compact, and conclusive, I should add that the position defended is in accord with my conviction before reading this work. Highly intelligent opinion can be found against this view, and it might be well to get a report from someone who holds this contrary position. Such persons are to be found in this faculty and in the economics department. From the standpoint of desirability of publishing the book in this country, I may note some grounds for doubt. The author is an Austrian refugee, a very able economist who has been a professor at the London School of Economics since the middle 30s. He writes from a distinctly English point of view and frequently uses the expression "this country" with that reference. While there is some treatment of American conditions and citation of American writings, this is secondary in scope and emphasis. This fact in itself might limit the appeal in this country to a fairly cultivated, even academic, circle of readers. Moreover, the whole discussion is pitched at a quite high intellectual and scholarly level, and the amount of knowledge of Central European conditions and history assumed is rather large for even the educated American audience. It is hardly a popular book from this point of view. In addition, there are limitations in connection with the treatment itself, both as to the theoretical and the historical argument. In the latter connection, the work is essentially negative. It hardly considers the problem of alternatives, and inadequately recognizes the necessity, as well as political inevitability, of a wide range of governmental activity in relation to economic life in the future. It deals only with the simpler fallacies, unreasonable demands and romantic prejudices which underlie the popular clamor for governmental control in place of free enterprise. It does not discuss the problems set by the serious shortcomings of an economic system based on the degree of economic freedom, which was regarded as desirable and was allowed, say, around the turn of the century. And it does not attack fallacies in a very dramatic way, in comparison with the character of the thinking and argument on which they are actually based. The author's treatment of the course of events leading to the Nazi dictatorship in Germany also strikes me as open to attack on the ground of oversimplification. He practically attributes everything to the socialist movement and state paternalism toward labor and industry, including the cultivation of an attitude of contempt for business enterprise in comparison with esteem for bureaucratic status on a salary. He explicitly relegates the militaristic tradition to a minor role. It seems to me that there are many factors in German history which would call for consideration in a balanced treatment. One thinks of the late survival of feudalism, retarding of national unification and industrialization, and the special circumstances surrounding these changes and the establishment of responsible government after the First World War. These last surely had much to do with the breakdown of parliamentarism, an undoubted fact, and a vital factor in the establishment of the Hitler regime. I recall only a brief mention of anti-Semitism, which has a long history in Germany. These matters do not, in my own mind, invalidate the author's general conclusion, but they weaken the argument as a presentation of his case. In sum, the book is an able piece of work, but limited in scope and somewhat one-sided in treatment. I doubt whether it would have a very wide market in this country, or would change the position of many readers. Reader's Report by Jacob Marshak. December 20, 1943. The current discussion between advocates and adversaries of free enterprise has not been conducted so far on a very high level. Hayek's book may start in this country a more scholarly kind of debate. The book will appeal to friends of free enterprise and give them new material. Hayek's interpretation of the modern English scene, labor and industrial monopolist driving jointly toward a collective economy, will be new to all American readers except those who have read or listened to William Benton's impressions. While Hayek's German background enables him to give new support to the contention that socialism is the father of Nazism. Those who are not convinced in advance of Hayek's thesis will probably learn from his argument even more than those who are. Hayek, Chapter 4, has a wholesome contempt for the quasi-scientific method of trends, waves of tomorrow. Those who love planning because they love the inevitable will, perhaps, after reading Hayek, revise either their faith or their tastes. Perhaps they will start to think in terms of ends and means instead of in prophecies. It is true that Hayek himself gives little food for such concrete thinking. As he says himself at the end of the book, pages 177 and 179, the book is almost exclusively critical, not constructive. Its technique is black and white. It is impatient of compromises, page 31. It is written with the passion and the burning clarity of a great doctrinaire. Hayek has the sincerity of one who has had the vision of a danger which the others have not seen. He warns his fellow men with loving impatience. Accordingly, the best chapters of the book are negative or formal. There is an excellent and truly inspiring chapter on the rule of law, chapter 6. But Hayek has little to say as to how the rule of law, i.e. the avoidance of administrative decisions ad hoc, might be applied to create instruments for mitigating unemployment by monetary means, or for combating monopolists. On such points, he gives only vague hints, page 90 and page 147. Since in this country the terms plan and socialism have often been used to include monetary and fiscal policies, social security, and even progressive income tax, the American reader will possibly expect from Hayek a more concrete demarcation between what the book calls planning in the good sense and the undesirable planning proper. In fact, the non-economic chapters, that on the end of truth, for example, are more impressive than the economic ones. Those who read Walter Lippmann, Stuart Chase, or The Fortune's discussions on the post-war world will also read Hayek. He is often less concrete than Lippmann or Chase, but his thinking is somewhat sharper, just because it is more abstract. Hayek's style is readable and occasionally inspiring. This book cannot be bypassed. J. Marshak. Foreword to the 1944 American edition by John Chamberlain. The shibboleths of our times are expressed in a variety of terms. Full employment, planning, social security, freedom from want. The facts of our times suggest that none of these things can be had when they are made conscious objects of government policy. They are the fool's gold words. In Italy, they debauched a people and led to death under the burning African suns. In Russia, there was the first five-year plan. There was also the liquidation of the 3 million kulaks. In Germany, there was full employment between 1935 and 1939, but 600,000 Jews are now deprived of their property, scattered to the ends of the earth, or lying in mass graves in the Polish forests. And in America, the pump never quite filled up after the successive primings. War alone saved the politicians of full employment. To date, only a handful of writers has dared to trace a connection between our shibboleths and the terror that haunts the modern world. Among these writers is F.A. Hayek, an Austrian economist now living in England. Having watched the congealing of the German the Italian, and the Danubian social and economic systems, Hayek is horrified to see the English succumbing by degrees to the controlled economy ideas of the German Walter Rathenau, the Italian syndicalists, yes, and Adolf Hitler, who had the courage to draw conclusions from the less forthright statism of his predecessors. This book of Hayek's, The Road to Serfdom, is a warning, a cry in a time of hesitation. It says to the British, and by implication to Americans, stop, look, and listen. The Road to Serfdom is sober, logical, severe. It does not make for ingratiating reading. But the logic is incontestable. Full employment, social security, and freedom from want cannot be had unless they come as byproducts of a system that releases the free energies of individuals. When society and the good of the whole and the greatest good of the greatest number are made the overmastering touchstones of state action, no individual can plan his own existence. For the state planners must arrogate to themselves the right to move in on any sector of the economic system if the good of society or the general welfare is paramount. If the rights of the individual get in the way, the rights of the individual must go. The threat of state dynamism results in a vast, usually unconscious fear among all producing interests that still retain a conditional freedom of action. And the fear affects the springs of action. Men must try to outguess the government as yesterday they tried to outguess the market. But there is this difference. The market factors obeyed at least relatively objective laws, while governments are subject to a good deal of whim. One can stake one's future on a judgment that reckons with inventories, market saturation points, the interest rate, the trend curves of buyers' desires. But how can an individual outguess a government whose aim is to suspend the objective laws of the market whenever and wherever it wishes to do so in the name of planning? Shrewdly, Peter Drucker once remarked that the planners are all improvisers. They create not certainty but uncertainty for individuals. And, as Hayek demonstrates, the end result of this uncertainty is civil war, or the dictatorship that averts civil war. The alternative to planning is the rule of law. Hayek is no devotee of laissez-faire. He believes in a design for an enterprise system. Design is compatible with minimum wage standards, health standards, a minimum amount of compulsory social insurance. It is even compatible with certain types of government investment. But the point is that the individual must know in advance just how the rules are going to work. He cannot plan his own business, his own future, even his own family affairs, if the dynamism of a central planning authority hangs over his head. In some respects, Hayek is more English than the modern English. He belongs, with modifications, to the great Manchester line, not to the school of the Webbs. It may be that he is also more American than the modern Americans. If so, one can only wish for the widest possible United States audience for The Road to Serfdom. John Chamberlain, New York, New York, July 1944. Letter from John Schoon to C. Hartley Grattan. Hayek, The Road to Serfdom. May 2, 1945. Mr. C. Hartley Grattan, 6 Whitehall Road, Tuckahoe, New York. Dear Mr. Grattan, I have been in the office about 5 minutes a day since I returned to Chicago, or you certainly would have heard from me before this. The reviews were sent to you over a week ago, however, and for your purposes they tell the main story. The Road to Serfdom came to us in December 1943, was read by 2 scholarly readers outside of the press, and was approved by our publications committee, made up of faculty members from various departments of the university, at the end of that month. It was in page proofs when we first saw it, and about to be published by Routledge in England. The idea of the presses publishing it in this country was suggested by a member of the Department of Economics at the university who had previously known Hayek and his work. Almost simultaneously, another friend of the author's, once at the university but then in Washington with the government, suggested the book to us and got us the page proofs. The first report, a copy of which I am enclosing, marked A, was from a man who is very reliable, pretty middle of the road in his political stand, and respected by both sides. He says in his report that he was on Hayek's side in this matter even before reading the book, so he recommended that we get another report from the opposition. This we did, and the report labeled B came from one of the most definitely progressive economists in the country, whose name you would recognize immediately if it were not our long-standing policy never to reveal readers' names. In other words, we simply could not have given the book a more objective trial. We didn't know a thing about it at that time, so we got reports from two opposing points of view and then laid them before a committee composed of 13 men of differing shades of opinion. They approved publication of the book by the press. That was all before Mr. Brandt and I came to the press at the beginning of January 1944. We found this project in the vault with many others, part of the probable program for the year just beginning then. As the press started to make up its new list, the road to serfdom looked far from world-shaking. Then we read the page proofs ourselves and decided to ask the author to be specific about the book's application to the United States, explicitly mentioning this country where he included it in his thought instead of slanting the book directly at an audience limited to England, making no promises as to publication which might influence his judgment on this point, my memo read. It went on to say, if he agrees, let's take it on. It will stir up trouble, but the author has a point and evidently has had excellent experience. I should explain here that the committee's approval of a manuscript is not mandatory, so the question of publication had not yet been completely decided. This process was agreed upon by all parties, and we, a colleague of the author's, and Mr. Hayek himself, all set to work suggesting possible revisions. Specific changes were eventually agreed upon, Mr. Hayek, of course, having the final say about what was added, what was deleted, and the specific wording in each spot. Meanwhile, we at the press were worrying about a possible new title, the sort of sales the book would have. It was taken on purely as a scholarly work, and we knew it would either fall pretty flat or catch on very widely. And how best to introduce this work by a foreign author without much of a name in this country? After much conferring, we decided to leave the title, a paraphrase of Bertrand Russell's Roads to Freedom, to ask John Chamberlain to write an introduction to the book and to have a first printing of 2,000 copies. This figure was definitely influenced by the competition the book faced in the previously published Omnipotent Government by Ludwig von Mises, Hayek's one-time teacher in Vienna. About the time the contract for American rights was signed, the beginning of April, we began to hear about the book in England, which had been published there on March 10th. The first printing in England was only 2,000, but it was sold out in about a month. It began to be quoted in Parliament and in newspapers, and a few newspapers over here began mentioning it now and then. But of course, we were still uncertain as to how it would appeal to the United States. As a matter of fact, right up until publication date, we couldn't get a bookstore, even in New York, excited about the book. Although Joe Margolis of Brentano's did allow it some sales possibilities. Into June, the author was correcting our proofs, and publication, which we had hoped for in July, was delayed until September 18th, by which time the English edition was in its third printing. We sent out more advance copies and review copies than usual, and from the response, we knew that the book would have a good chance of catching on. The first review that we saw was Orville Prescott's in the New York Times of September 20th, which was neutral and called it "This Sad and Angry Little Book." But by the time we had seen Henry Hazlitt's front page review in the Sunday Times Book Review, we had ordered a second printing of 5,000 copies. In a few days, we had requests for German, Spanish, Dutch, and other translation rights. And on September 27th, we ordered a third printing of 5,000 copies, upping it to 10,000 the next day. Requests for magazine rights came from several sources, but the Reader's Digest was first and made the best offer. By the first week of October, many stores were out of stock, and we had a tremendous and intricate job of printing, binding, shipping and allotting to customers in both this country and Canada. By this time, we had made an arrangement with Routledge to take care of Canadian orders too. From the start, there was great enthusiasm for the book, but the sales went by ups and downs, and our advertising agency had a real headache getting space at the right times. A few book programs on the radio boosted the book toward the end of October, but we knew that its sales would fall off after Christmas, so we began casting about for something to do with it this year. Mr. Brandt got the idea of bringing Mr. Hayek over here. He called the departments of economics at several universities about the possibility, and all were very enthusiastic. As soon as definite arrangements had been made, and it became known that Mr. Hayek was coming to this country, organizations and individuals of all sorts overwhelmed us with efforts to get hold of him, and we had to turn the trip over to the National Concert and Artists Corporation. The rest of the story you know. The book, now in its seventh printing, has sold nearly 50,000, but orders are coming in so fast that we don't know the exact total. Actually, it has had one of the most eccentric sales careers a book ever had, and it has been very difficult to know what to do next with it. The digest condensation caused a great spurt, but the spurt did not hold, very likely because of the Book of the Month Club's distribution of the condensation, which has now reached a figure above 600,000. Bitterness about the book has increased as time has gone by, rising to new heights as the book has made more of an impression. People still tend to go off half-cocked about it. Why don't they read it and find out what Hayek actually says? You also know how the author feels about this. One of his regrets is that, in a way, his conclusions are down on paper, but not the process by which he arrived at them. And we are all wondering whether someday we should not bring out a fully annotated edition of the book. This edition is being used as collateral reading in political science and similar courses at a number of universities. Meanwhile, Hayek has many other projects on hand, none of which we should talk about now. I hope that this will suffice for your needs. I have gathered the material out of the files and may have lost something in perspective. If there is anything more that you would like to know, we will try to supply it. Yours sincerely, John Schoon, Editor. JSMB. Introduction to the 1994 edition by Milton Friedman. This book has become a true classic, essential reading for everyone who is seriously interested in politics in the broadest and least partisan sense. A book whose central message is timeless, applicable to a wide variety of concrete situations. In some ways, it is even more relevant to the United States today than it was when it created a sensation on its original publication in 1944. Nearly a quarter of a century ago, 1971, I wrote an introduction to a new German edition of The Road to Serfdom that illustrates how timeless Hayek's message is. That introduction is equally relevant to this 50th anniversary edition of Hayek's classic. Rather than plagiarize myself, I herewith quote it in full before adding a few additional comments. Over the years, I have made it a practice to inquire of believers in individualism how they came to depart from the collectivist orthodoxy of our times. For years, the most frequent answer was a reference to the book for which I have the honor of writing this introduction. Professor Hayek's remarkable and vigorous tract was a revelation particularly to the young men and women who had been in the armed forces during the war. Their recent experience had enhanced their appreciation of the value and meaning of individual freedom. In addition, they had observed a collectivist organization in action. For them, Hayek's predictions about the consequences of collectivism were not simply hypothetical possibilities, but visible realities that they had themselves experienced in the military. On rereading the book before writing this introduction, I was again impressed with what a magnificent book it is. Subtle and closely reasoned, yet lucid and clear. Philosophical and abstract, yet also concrete and realistic. Analytical and rational, yet animated by high ideals and a vivid sense of mission. Little wonder that it had so great an influence. I was impressed also that its message is no less needed today than it was when it first appeared. On this, more later. but its message may not be as immediate or as persuasive to today's youth as to the young men and women who read it when it first appeared. The problems of the war and post-war adjustment that Hayek used to illustrate his timeless central thesis, and the collectivist jargon of the time that he used to document his assertions about the intellectual climate, were familiar to the immediate post-war generation and established an immediate rapport between author and reader. The same collectivist fallacies are abroad and on the rise today, but the immediate issues are different, and so is much of the jargon. Today we hear little of central planning, of production for use, of the need for conscious direction of society's resources. Instead, the talk is of the urban crisis, solvable, it is said, only by vastly expanded government programs, of the environmental crisis, produced, it is said, by rapacious businessmen who must be forced to discharge their social responsibility instead of simply operating their enterprises to make the most profit, and requiring also, it is said, vastly expanded government programs, of the consumer crisis, false values stimulated by the selfsame rapacious businessmen seeking profits instead of exercising social responsibility, and, of course, also requiring expanded government programs to protect the consumer, not least from himself. Of the welfare or poverty crisis. Here the jargon is still poverty in the midst of plenty. Though what is now described as poverty would have been regarded as plenty when that slogan was first widely used. Now, as then, the promotion of collectivism is combined with the profession of individualist values. Indeed, experience with big government has strengthened this discordant strand. There is wide protest against the establishment, an incredible conformity in the protest against conformity, a widespread demand for freedom to do one's own thing, for individual lifestyles, for participatory democracy. Listening to this strand, one might also believe that the collectivist tide has turned, that individualism is again on the rise. As Hayek so persuasively demonstrates, these values require an individualistic society. They can be achieved only in a liberal order. I use the term liberal, as Hayek does, in the original 19th century sense of limited government and free markets, not in the corrupted sense it has acquired in the United States, in which it means almost the opposite, in which government activity is limited primarily to establishing the framework within which individuals are free to pursue their own objectives. The free market is the only mechanism that has ever been discovered for achieving participatory democracy. Unfortunately, the relation between the ends and the means remains widely misunderstood. Many of those who profess the most individualistic objectives support collectivist means without recognizing the contradiction. It is tempting to believe that social evils arise from the activities of evil men, and that if only good men, like ourselves, naturally wielded power, all would be well. That view requires only emotion and self-praise, easy to come by and satisfying as well. To understand why it is that good men in positions of power will produce evil, while the ordinary man without power, but able to engage in voluntary cooperation with his neighbors, will produce good, requires analysis and thought, subordinating the emotions to the rational faculty. Surely that is one answer to the perennial mystery of why collectivism, with its demonstrated record of producing tyranny and misery, is so widely regarded as superior to individualism, with its demonstrated record of producing freedom and plenty. The argument for collectivism is simple, if false. It is an immediate emotional argument. The argument for individualism is subtle and sophisticated. It is an indirect rational argument. And the emotional faculties are more highly developed in most men than the rational, paradoxically, or especially, even in those who regard themselves as intellectuals. How stands the battle between collectivism and individualism in the West more than a quarter of a century, now half a century, after the publication of Hayek's great tract? The answer is very different in the world of affairs and in the world of ideas. In the world of affairs, those of us who were persuaded by Hayek's analysis saw few signs in 1945 of anything but a steady growth of the state at the expense of the individual, a steady replacement of private initiative and planning by state initiative and planning. Yet in practice, that movement did not go much farther, not in Britain or in France or in the United States. And in Germany, there was a sharp reaction away from the totalitarian controls of the Nazi period, and a major move toward a liberal economic policy. What produced this unexpected check to collectivism? I believe that two forces were primarily responsible. First, and this was particularly important in Britain, the conflict between central planning and individual liberty that is Hayek's theme became patent, particularly when the exigencies of central planning led to the so-called control of engagements order, under which the government had the power to assign people to occupations. The tradition of liberty, the liberal values, were still sufficiently strong in Britain so that, when the conflict occurred, central planning was sacrificed rather than individual liberty. The second force checking collectivism was simply its inefficiency. Government proved unable to manage enterprises, to organize resources to achieve stated objectives at reasonable cost. It became mired in bureaucratic confusion and inefficiency. Widespread disillusionment set in about the effectiveness of centralized government in administering programs. Unfortunately, the check to collectivism did not check the growth of government. Rather, it diverted its growth to a different channel. The emphasis shifted from governmentally administered production activities to indirect regulation of supposedly private enterprises, and even more to governmental transfer programs, involving extracting taxes from some in order to make grants to others, all in the name of equality and the eradication of poverty, but in practice producing an erratic and contradictory melange of subsidies to special interest groups. As a result, the fraction of the national income being spent by governments has continued to mount. In the world of ideas, the outcome has been even less satisfactory to a believer in individualism. In one respect, this is most surprising. Experience in the past quarter century has strongly confirmed the validity of Hayek's central insight, that coordination of men's activities through central direction and through voluntary cooperation are roads going in very different directions, the first to serfdom, the second to freedom. That experience has also strongly reinforced a secondary theme. Central direction is also a road to poverty for the ordinary man. Voluntary cooperation, a road to plenty. East and West Germany almost provide a controlled scientific experiment. Here are people of the same blood, the same civilization, the same level of technical skill and knowledge, torn asunder by the accidents of warfare, yet adopting radically different methods of social organization, central direction, and the market. The results are crystal clear. East Germany, not West Germany, had to build a wall to keep its citizens from leaving. On its side of the wall, tyranny and misery. On the other side, freedom and affluence. In the Middle East, Israel and Egypt offer the same contrast as West and East Germany. In the Far East, Malaya, Singapore, Thailand, Formosa, Hong Kong, and Japan, all relying primarily on free markets, are thriving and their people full of hope. A far call from India, Indonesia, and communist China, all relying heavily on central planning. Again, it is communist China and not Hong Kong that has to guard its borders against people trying to get out. Yet despite this remarkable and dramatic confirmation of Hayek's thesis, the intellectual climate of the West, after a brief interlude in which there were some signs of the resurgence of earlier liberal values, has again started moving in a direction strongly antagonistic to free enterprise, competition, private property, and limited government. For a time, Hayek's description of the ruling intellectual attitudes seemed to be growing somewhat obsolete. Today, it rings truer than it did a decade ago. It is hard to know what explains this development. We badly need a new book by Hayek that will give as clear and penetrating an insight into the intellectual developments of the past quarter century as the road to serfdom does of earlier developments. Why is it that intellectual classes everywhere almost automatically range themselves on the side of collectivism, even while chanting individualist slogans, and denigrate and revile capitalism? Why is it that the mass media are almost everywhere dominated by this view? Whatever the explanation, the fact of growing intellectual support of collectivism, and I believe it is a fact, makes Hayek's book as timely today as it was when it first appeared. Let us hope that a new edition in Germany, which of all countries should be most receptive to its message, will have as much influence as the initial edition had in the United States and the United Kingdom. The battle for freedom must be won over and over again. The socialists in all parties to whom Hayek dedicated his book must once again be persuaded or defeated if they and we are to remain free men. The penultimate paragraph of my introduction to the German edition is the only one that does not ring fully true today. The fall of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of communism behind the Iron Curtain, and the changing character of China have reduced the defenders of a Marxian-type collectivism to a small, hardy band concentrated in Western universities. Today there is wide agreement that socialism is a failure, capitalism a success. Yet, this apparent conversion of the intellectual community to what might be called a Hayekian view is deceptive. While the talk is about free markets and private property, and it is more respectable than it was a few decades ago to defend near-complete laissez-faire, the bulk of the intellectual community almost automatically favors any expansion of government power, so long as it is advertised as a way to protect individuals from big bad corporations, relieve poverty, protect the environment, or promote equality. The present discussion of a national program of health care provides a striking example. The intellectuals may have learned the words, but they do not yet have the tune. I said at the outset that, in some ways, the message of this book is even more relevant to the United States today than it was when it created a sensation half a century ago. Intellectual opinion then was far more hostile to its theme than it appears to be now, but practice conformed to it far more than it does today. Government in the post-World War II period was smaller and less intrusive than it is today. Johnson's Great Society programs, including Medicare and Medicaid, and Bush's Clean Air and Americans with Disabilities Acts were all still ahead, let alone the numerous other extensions of government that Reagan was only able to slow down, not reverse, in his 8 years in office. Total government spending, federal, state, and local in the United States, has gone from 25% of national income in 1950 to nearly 45% in 1993. Much the same has been true in Britain, in one sense more dramatically. The Labour Party, formerly openly socialist, now defends free private markets, and the Conservative Party, once content to administer Labour's socialist policies, has tried to reverse, and to some extent, under Margaret Thatcher, succeeded in reversing the extent of government ownership and operation. But Thatcher was unable to call on anything like the reservoir of popular support for liberal values that led to the withdrawal of the control of engagements order shortly after World War II. And while there has been a considerable amount of privatization, there as here, government today spends a larger fraction of the national income and is more intrusive than it was in 1950. On both sides of the Atlantic, it is only a little overstated to say that we preach individualism and competitive capitalism and practice socialism. Note on publishing history. Hayek began working on The Road to Serfdom in September 1940, and the book was first published in England on March 10, 1944. Hayek authorized his friend, Dr. Fritz Machlup, an Austrian refugee who pursued a distinguished academic career in the United States and was employed in 1944 at the Office of Alien Property Custodian in Washington, D.C., to sign up the book with an American publisher. Before it was submitted to the University of Chicago Press, the book was turned down in the United States by three publishers, whether because they believed it would not sell or, in at least one case, because they considered it unfit for publication by a reputable house. Undeterred, Machlup showed the page proofs of the British edition to Aaron Director, a former member of the University of Chicago Economics Department, who was to return to the university after the war as an economist in the law school. Subsequently, Frank H. Knight, a distinguished economist at the university, received a set of proofs and presented them to the University of Chicago Press with director's suggestion that the press might want to publish the book. The press signed a contract with Hayek for American Rights in April 1944, after persuading him to make some changes. To be specific about the application to the United States, instead of slanting the book directly at an audience limited to England, as John Schoon, then editor at the press, later recalled. About the time the contract for American Rights was signed, the beginning of April, we began to hear about the book in England, which had been published there on March 10th. The first printing in England was only 2,000, but it was sold out in about a month. It began to be quoted in Parliament and in newspapers, and a few newspapers over here began mentioning it now and then. But of course, we were still uncertain as to how it would appeal to the United States. As a matter of fact, right up until publication date, we couldn't get a bookstore even in New York excited about the book. The Chicago edition was published on September 18, 1944, in a first printing of 2,000 copies with an introduction by John Chamberlain, then, as now, a well-known writer and reviewer of books on economic subjects. The first review that we saw, Schoon went on to say, was Orville Prescott's in the New York Times of September 20th, which was neutral and called it "This Sad and Angry Little Book." But by the time we had seen Henry Hazlitt's front-page review in the Sunday Times Book Review, we had ordered a second printing of 5,000 copies. In a few days, we had requests for German, Spanish, Dutch, and other translating rights. And on September 27th, we ordered a third printing of 5,000 copies, upping it to 10,000 the next day. By the first week of October, many stores were out of stock, and we had a tremendous and intricate job of printing, binding, shipping, and allotting to customers in both this country and Canada. From the start, there was great enthusiasm for the book, but the sales went by ups and downs. Bitterness about the book has increased as time has gone by, rising to new heights as the book has made more of an impression. People still tend to go off half-cocked about it. Why don't they read it and find out what Hayek actually says? Schoon's comment is still true today. The Reader's Digest published a condensation in April 1945, and more than 600,000 copies of the condensed version were subsequently distributed by the Book of the Month Club. In anticipation of the Digest's condensation, and also of a lecture tour that Hayek was scheduled to make in the spring of 1945, the press tried to arrange for a large seventh printing. However, a paper shortage limited the press run to 10,000 and forced the press to reduce the size of the book to a pocket-sized version. It is a copy from that printing, incidentally, that is in my personal library. In the 50 years since its publication, the press has sold over 250,000 copies, 81,000 in hardback and 175,000 in paperback. Chicago's first paperback edition was published in 1956. Hayek's son, Lawrence, reports that nearly 20 authorized foreign translations have been published. In addition, underground, unauthorized translations circulated in Russian, Polish, Czech, and possibly other languages, when Eastern Europe was behind the Iron Curtain. There is little doubt that Hayek's writings, and especially this book, were an important intellectual source of the disintegration of faith in communism behind the Iron Curtain, as on our side of it. Since the fall of the Berlin Wall, it has been possible to publish the book openly in the countries and satellites of the former Soviet Union. I know from a variety of sources that there has been an upsurge of interest in Hayek in general, and the road to serfdom in particular in those countries. Since Hayek's death in 1992, there has been increasing recognition of the influence that he exerted in both communist and non-communist countries. His publishers can confidently look forward to continuing sales of this remarkable book for as long as freedom of the press prevails, which, despite some erosion since he wrote, is nonetheless more secure than it would otherwise be precisely because of this book. Stanford, California, April 14, 1994. This concludes the reading of The Road to Serfdom, the Definitive Edition, Text and Documents, by F. A. Hayek. Copyright 2007 by the estate of F. A. Hayek. Original text, copyright 1944 by the University of Chicago. This book was read by William Hughes. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with the University of Chicago Press and was produced in 2017 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.